This is the KGOU Readers Club. I'm KGOU Managing Editor Logan Layden. Our book this month is Jim Thorpe, World's Greatest Athlete, from author Robert Wheeler back in 1975, but it's being re-released with a new preface and in collaboration with Dr. Florence Ridlon. Robert Wheeler, Dr. Ridlon, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Logan. It's an honor to be here.
It certainly is.
Well, absolutely. I'm looking forward to the conversation. I want to do full disclosure here just at the beginning of the show, though. You guys just haven't worked together on this new preface and the book, but you have a personal relationship as well. Yeah,
that's true. We've been married 52.
52.
I see. Well, let's get into it. I do want to spend a little bit of time here at the beginning of the show just talking about, for you, Bob, and for you, Flo, just about you've put a significant amount of your life's work into Jim Thorpe. Can you give me a little bit of a sense of how that came to be, why you decided to go in that direction? What prompted you to, even decades ago, begin this intensive research into this man's life?
Be glad to, Logan. Hopefully some of your listeners with children, this will resonate with them. When I was 10 years old, for my birthday, I still have the book. My father gave me a birthday book called 100 Greatest Sports Heroes by Mac Davis. And Logan, I read the book from cover to cover, and Jack Dempsey and Babe Ruth and Ty Cobb and Bobby Jones, the list goes on, 100. And I went to my father and I said, Dad, why was this history book spoiled by a Paul Bunyan figure inserted into it? And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, there in this book, it says there was this athlete that was a world-class competitor in 22 sports, including being the national dancing champion. I said, Dad, that's just not possible. And my father said, what was his name? And I said, Jim Thorpe. And he sat me down, and my father was a great student of Indian history, and he told me that Jim Thorpe was a real person. And that just was something that I couldn't get out of my mind. So years later, I'm a senior in high school, and my parents said, what would you like for a present? And I said, I grew up in Rochester, New York. I said, I'd love to see the Yankees play. So we drove to New York, and on the way back, I'm looking at the road map, and there's a place called Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania. So I said, could we stop there? And they said, sure. And Logan, we spent 3 hours looking through the graveyard, looking for a Thorpe headstone, found none, and we're leaving. And I've never done this before, but I saw some kind of a structure off in the field on top of one of the Pocono Mountains. And I said, could we stop and see what that is? So we did, and we walked across the highway over to this. It was a bunch of very tall weeds. And we pulled the weeds apart, and there was a mausoleum that had been horribly vandalized. And it said, Jim Thorpe, 1888-1953, you, sir, are the greatest athlete in the world, King Gustav V of Sweden. So we get back to Rochester, and now I'm just really on fire to find out about Jim Thorpe. I go to the huge library in downtown Rochester, nothing on Jim Thorpe. So I copied down the names and addresses of the ones I felt were the top sports historians. And this is incredible that, and again, your listeners might relate to this. I sent 10 letters to these sports writers saying, could you tell me where I could find any information about Jim Thorpe, because there's no books on him. And only one responded, but it literally changed my life, because it was Colonel Alexander Weyand, a great sports historian. And he wrote, in the interest of scholarship, you will no doubt carefully analyze all stories that come to your attention. Some ridiculous stories concerning Thorpe have been published in magazines and books and have been solemnly repeated by reliable writers as such as Granlin Rice and Arthur Daly. I might add Pulitzer Prize winners. I repeat, watch carefully what you write, because more lies have been written about Jim Thorpe than about any player in football history. So I had trouble getting permission when I was in college wanting to do this for my thesis. So I hitchhiked down to New York from Syracuse University, and that was Richard B. Morris, the famous American historian at Columbia University, and he loved my idea of doing an oral history. And so, again, with my parents' permission, and again, this is a time totally different from today. As you were saying, 50-odd years ago, hitchhiking wasn't suicidal back then. So with a 30-pound tape recorder, reel-to-reel, I hitchhiked 12,000 miles and interviewed 200 of Jim Thorpe's family and competitors in the National Football League and in the Major League Baseball. And that was the basis of my book.
Well, it's amazing that even, you know, at that time, you say there hadn't been any, you know, books written about him, about Jim Thorpe. When you look at these lists, and you have some of them here toward the end of the original book, naming, and these were put out in the 50s, the greatest athletes of the first half of the 20th century. And you see often Babe Ruth second, and first is Jim Thorpe. It's just so interesting how that could have been, somewhat lost in that short period of time. And that was near the end of his life, right? I think he passed in the early 50s, right? 1953.
Yeah, 53.
Well,
and what's amazing, again, in that time, there were no cell phones, no computers, no emails, no texts. I would show up at people's homes or offices, depending upon the hour of the day, and Logan, no one turned me down. Burt Lancaster was in the middle of filming The Scalp Hunters with Shelley Winters, Telly Savalas, Ossie Davis. He shut down the production so he could talk about Jim Thorpe. President Eisenhower, I rang his doorbell, and I hear in Gettysburg, and hear over a loudspeaker, it sounded like he was coming from the heavens, "State your business." And I told him why I was there, and I hear footsteps on a wooden staircase, and his assistant, General Schultz, a four-star general, invited me upstairs and into President Eisenhower's office. And I could tell he was reading a dissertation, and he got up and walked toward me, very frail. This was during the time of 7 heart attacks that he was going through. He walked over to me, and instead of reaching out and shaking my hand, he reached into his back pocket and pulled out his wallet, because he could see the Gettysburg sign that I had taped onto the tape recorder. And he said, "I do not approve of hitchhiking. It's very dangerous. If I give you this money, would you promise not to hitchhike anymore?" So I told a white lie. I just was not going to take his money, and I promised him I would. I said I did have money, which I really didn't. But he then invited me to sit down in a rocking chair across from his rocking chair. And Logan, he remembered every play that he competed against Jim Thorpe for the national championship college football in 1912. He had 5 future generals as teammates, and they lost decidedly to Jim Thorpe and the Carlisle Indians. And was just, again, everybody I spoke with, Mrs. Whistler, Jim's teacher at Carlisle, I read in an article, I said to her, I read that Jim was a failure as a student. Huh. And you could tell, Logan, she was kind of sizing me up. Here I am in her home. She's an elderly woman. And after about 5 minutes of conversation, she excused herself and she came back and gave me Jim's report card. And it was in great detail, and it was a solid B average. So, again, that racist myth was not true.
There are so many falsehoods out there, or have been, at least over the course of the last century plus about Jim Thorpe, and that's one of them, that he was somehow a poor student, which just wasn't true. Dr. Ritalin Flo, when did you get involved in this? So he must have been doing this around the same time that the two of you were developing your relationship. Tell me where your passion about Jim Thorpe comes from.
Actually, well, I was involved in earlier things, but not to any great extent. But it was in 1982 when we decided that if Jim Thorpe was ever going to get his medals back, this was the time to do it, because the Olympics were coming up, coming up in L.A., and we were just switching between jobs, so it was a time when we actually had a month or two of break. So we just decided that we would form a foundation and work really hard to get Jim Thorpe's medals returned. So 1982 was my really strong involvement started. And it started because, I guess, basically because I am a sociologist, and Jim Thorpe is such a role model for Native Americans. And it really got to me that his reputation was destroyed and his medals were taken away. And they were taken away illegally. And the whole thing was so unethical that we decided that we just had to really push hard at that time.
Yeah, and it's important to note for both of you, not just, you know, writing this book and the new updated version with the new preface, but were played a very important role in the eventual return of Jim Thorpe's medals, or his recognition that he did legitimately win these events and deserved these gold medals from the 1912 Olympics. So your involvement with the Jim Thorpe situation goes well beyond doing research and writing a book, right?
Well, thanks. Yeah, it's been a passion with both of us since 1982.
Well, let's talk about the book. And once again, I want to make clear to the listeners that Jim Thorpe, World's Greatest Athlete, that was published back in 1975, right?
Yes.
And here we are 50 years later. There's a new version of it with a new preface, a long preface, because a lot has been learned in that meantime between 1975 and now. Some real context to what we get in the first version of the book. And I do want to talk about that. But just as far as the structure of the book goes, that new preface that we have comes before what, at least I understand, is simply the original version of the book, right? There were no changes to the actual content of the original version. It's just the preface that is new. Is that right?
Yes. And in the preface, we state that history is an evolving study, and to give you an example, Jim's letter of confession, handwritten, signed by Jim, he didn't write it, and thanks to the incredible work that historians in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, with the Cumberland County Historical Society and Dickinson College, they have unearthed literally thousands of letters, report cards, grades, all sorts of documents, and they're putting that together. And what really happened is that Pop Warner, Jim's football and track coach at the Carlisle Indian School, walked into his dorm room and forced him to copy this letter that he had, his confession letter, that he had played summer baseball and therefore was not an amateur and had to give up his gold medal from the Olympics. He forced Jim to sign that. And Jim did not have a lawyer. He did not have any counseling. He did not even get to meet with the AAU. The racism was so profound back then. We could talk for an hour on the racism that Jim and the Carlisle Indian students suffered In fact, it was so extreme that the quarterback of the Carlisle football team, a student at Carlisle, starts a petition saying about the dishonesty and the stealing and the treatment that the students were receiving at the Carlisle Indian School. And he knocked on the door of a local congressman's home, and they sent an investigator over unannounced to Carlisle, and it ended up shutting down the school. That's how powerful Jim's friends were, and how powerful the abuse that the students were suffering at their time.
Yes, and it was Gus Welch, who was his teammate and roommate, and what really got him riled was that instead of standing by Jim Thorpe and admitting that he sent him to play the summer baseball, which he did, and instead of admitting that, he and Moses Friedman, the superintendent of the school, who also knew Jim played baseball, there's a written document that we see now where he's talking to the Indian agent, and he says that Jim has been allowed to go play summer baseball for 2 summers. So all this stuff has come to light since. I mean, initially we had Pop Warner was probably never our hero, but after this we realized that the collaboration between Pop Warner and James Sullivan, the head of the AAU and the American Olympic Committee at that time, was just horrendous. And they basically threw Jim under the bus to save their own careers. And so if we come down much harder on these characters at this point than Bob knew at the time. And I think one of the main things that's happened is that Jim was in Carlisle, which was a Native American boarding school, and his treatment was not bad. He had, at the time that we're talking about, the 1911-1912, his treatment was wonderful there because he played for Pop Warner, and Pop gave his team members just about everything. I mean, they had good meals, and they had free clothes and everything a student could possibly want. But this was not the case for everybody else at the boarding school. What's happened in the last 15, 20 years is we're finally starting to learn what the boarding schools were really like. And even though Jim didn't suffer much from being in a boarding school at that time, other students did.
Well, sure, and you're mentioning some names here. Pop Warner, which for anybody that knows much about football at all, should certainly ring a bell. Just the massive innovator coach. We still have, I think, Pop Warner youth football leagues to this day. Played a major role in Jim Thorpe's life, but as I think the preface makes clear, we have a little bit more context of that role as the decades have gone by. And I want to get to some of that. I do want to, just for our listeners, for me, this has been a real learning experience. I learned about Jim Thorpe in Oklahoma history class in middle school, growing up here in Oklahoma, but never dove into it the way that I did by going through this book, and now have this kind of full understanding of the life of Jim Thorpe. So I do want to give just a little bit of background before we get up to like the 1910 era, the Carlisle era, about Jim Thorpe's upbringing, his history early in his life, and what led him to Carlisle. As I think I have this about right, when he first gets there, or at least when he's first getting involved in athletics, he's 5'5", 115 pounds. If you can just tell me a little bit about Jim's early life leading up to when we get into the Pop Warner Carlisle days, what led him there?
Sure. you've done your homework. He was 5'5" and 115 pounds. Excuse me. When he entered Carlisle, he was not built to be an athlete at that point, and so he was sent for a couple of years on their outing system, where they would go to white families and learn a trade. And interestingly, his experience in that system, the outing system, when he would work all day in the home or in the field, he wasn't allowed to eat with the family, and that resonated with him. And it kind of made him a very determined and strong individual. But his beginning, a lot of people don't know this, he was a twin when he and Charlie were born in 1887, and his dad was Sac and Fox, his mom was Potawatomi. And I just want to send a quick thanks you to the Sac and Fox and Potawatomi archivists, because for 50 years I have searched for Charlie's name and was not able to find it. And they spent hours past midnight, day after day, week after week, and they found Charlie's name. Jim was Bright Path, his Sac and Fox name in Potawatomi. And
Bright Path, right, yeah.
Bright Path, yes. And the custom was the mother giving birth oftentimes would name the child after a sight that she had experienced. And so when Jim was born and Charlie, her pathway to the cabin was illuminated with lightning flashing in the sky, so she called Jim Bright Path Wathohuck. And Charlie, a lot's not known about him because he died of pneumonia from a disease in a boarding school when he was only 8 years old. Charlie's name was Pathfinder. And again, I thank the Potawatomi and the Sac and Fox archivist for finding that Simiata Pathfinder. But the when Jim was 10, to give you a little idea of his childhood, one of his favorite stories was playing the game Follow the Leader. And he would dive into the North Canadian River, if you can believe that was the name of it, in Oklahoma, and swim across it, and then climb over a fence, run underneath a wild bull, climb to the top of a fir tree and float down, and that was his favorite game. And it's interesting, one of his sons, of whom I interviewed with him, and along with all of Jim's children, I was blessed to be able to interview. He said that Chief Jack Thorpe, one of Jim's sons, told me the story that he got the top athlete in town and to try to replicate that Follow the Leader thing. And he said, we got the film crew and everybody ready, and this great athlete jumped into the Canadian River to swim across, and they had to pull him out because it was too hard for him to swim across it. So kind of reminds me of an Olympic historian say Jim was an athlete teleported from the future, as Dr. Bill Mallon told me that one. He said he was like a different life form in his athleticism. But Jim also said at the age of 15, he said, there wasn't a wild horse I couldn't catch, saddle, and ride. And then at 16, that's when he went to Carlisle. His father said, I want you to show the world what you can do. And he did that. And, you know, this is a time the founder of Carlisle, Richard Henry Pratt, and there was even a sign on the property of Carlisle that was his favorite slogan. It was, kill the Indian, save the man. Mm-hmm. This is what Jim encountered. And as Flo said, once he established himself as an athlete, then that was a whole different experience. And the treatment was different. But I think, you know, again, with history, one of the presidents that I always admired until I dove more and more into his writings, just as an example, Logan, is Theodore Roosevelt. And this is a quotation from the President of the United States. This is made up. This is from a speech he gave. He says, I don't go so far as to think that the only good Indians are the dead Indians, but I believe 9 out of every 10 are. But I shouldn't like to inquire too closely into the case of the 10th. The most vicious cowboy has more moral principle than the average Indian. That's from the President of the United States. So this was, as you said, his childhood that he grew up in. And again, the students, you know this, that upon entering Carlisle, their hair was cut, their clothes were burned in front of them. They were forced to use English names. And that was his experience there. And then, as he grew and became 5'11", 185 pounds, he became the captain of the football team and the track and field team and the basketball team, and played those sports. If you add it all up, Logan, he played for 21 years until his 41st birthday. Because he, after Carlisle, he went into the pros. Year-round, he played. He was a player, a coach, and in football, that, as you know, back then, with the leather helmets, he played offense and defense. And in 1911, it's one of my favorite stories, against Pitt, who were undefeated at the time. Carlisle won 17-0, but the play that people can't Adam, is that on one play, Jim dropped back, punted the ball 70 yards, raced down the field, outlet four Pitt defenders, caught his own punt, and raced 20 more yards for the touchdown. And,
no, it's...
and then the national championship game that year against Harvard, they didn't think he could play because his legs were all beat up, but he bandaged his legs. And he kicked four field goals, one from the 48-yard line, and did most of the running. And they won the game against Harvard for the national championship. And as I said earlier, in 1912, against President Eisenhower and West Point, they won the national championship that year as well.
Yeah, it's amazing. And we're talking about, you know, the Carlisle School, this Indian boarding school. They're playing these powerhouse college football teams. And beating them. But of course, I mean, it's important to remember, you know, at that school, the point of these schools was to basically try to strip these indigenous people of their traditions, of their ways, to try to Americanize them. You know, that is certainly part of this history as well. He ended up in the Carlisle School. That was up in Pennsylvania, right? And eventually, you know, he had his father's support to go there. But part of the reason was that he kept running home from escaping school that were closer to his home. Sometimes on foot. One of my favorite stories in the book is whenever he leaves, I believe, the school in Kansas, because he heard his dad was sick. And hops a train that ended up going north instead of south. And then once he realized that, he walked all the way back hundreds of miles.
200 miles, right?
Yeah.
You'd love this. I interviewed his roommate from Haskell. That's the school in Kansas. And his name was George Washington. There again, a name that was forced upon him. You'll love this story. He said that one day he and Jim were out in the field. And just for a break, Jim very casually would high jump over the split rail fences over and over again. And George had never seen anyone do that. So that afternoon, he ran to tell the coach, "You've got to look at this boy. He's only 12 years old, but here's what he's done." And the track and football coach said, "Send him here, send him here." And George went to get him, and as you told the story, Logan, that was the exact day that Jim ran away from the Haskell School, never to return.
Yes, indeed. So he needed to go further away, harder to walk from Pennsylvania. This is the KGOU Readers Club. Just to remind everybody, I'm managing editor Logan Layden. The book we are talking about right now is Jim Thorpe, World's Greatest Athlete. That's from Robert Wheeler, who I've got with me here, from 1975. I've also got Dr. Florence Ridlin, who also contributed to the whole Thorpe project, as well as the new preface to the book, which is why we're seeing this most recent re-release. Folks, you'll have to just read the book if you want all the details of Jim Thorpe's past. But as we get into these Carlisle days, they're this just amazing football team going up against the powerhouse collegiate teams of the time. And Jim Thorpe is really, in a lot of ways, the backbone of that team. But so was their coach. And I want to talk about Pop Warner some a little bit here, because when it comes to the preface, the new preface, you've seen Coach Warner in a bit of a new light. In the original version, he is very much sort of presented as basically being on Jim Thorpe's side the whole time, recognizing how special he was, working to make sure he was properly recognized and was able to fulfill his potential. But, okay, so for folks who don't know, whenever Jim Thorpe went to the Olympics, and again, we're not talking about football, Bob, as you mentioned, he was so expert in so many sports, including track and field. The 1912 Olympics, he goes there, and I'll let you just go ahead and tell folks, how did he perform in those Olympics?
Well, as I said earlier, the historian said he was teleported from the future. It was like he was running alone, the reporters at the Olympics would say. And maybe my favorite story from the Olympics, again, which would inspire, I know would inspire your audience, especially the younger listeners, is before the final event of the decathlon, the 1500 meters, Jim goes out to the field and he opens up his gym bag to put on his shoes, and someone had stolen his shoes. So he raced back into the locker room, and again, it was a very racist environment on the Olympic team. He slept in steerage on the way over to the Olympics on the ship. All the other athletes, most of the other athletes slept in first-class accommodations. The founder of the AAU and the U.S. Olympic Committee decided that James Sullivan said that he has to sleep, he and any minority sleep in steerage. So Bo and I interviewed, this was after the book was written, interviewed Jim's roommate on that ship, Abel Kiviat. And Abel was in his 90s when we talked to him, and I said, Abel, you are very, very proud of your, he kept saying, I'm Hebrew, your Jewish heritage, and it says here you ran for the Irish-American Athletic Club. And Abel said the reason for that is that if you were a world-class track athlete in the New York City area, and white with European genetic background, you ran to the New York Athletic Club. If you were a minority, you ran to the Irish American Athletic Club. That's why it lists me as running for the Irish American Athletic Club. But as Jim was now maybe a minute away from being disqualified from this race and losing the decathlon, which he was way ahead in, if he didn't compete in the last event, the 1500 meters, he found one shoe in the locker room that was too small, and he ran out onto the field. Now less than a minute, he takes a burn barrel, dumps it onto the field, and there's another shoe in there, a right shoe, which was too big. He threw on extra socks on the right foot and squeezed his left foot into the other shoe, made it to the starting time with seconds to spare, and set a world record with the 1500 meters and won the gold medal. So I love that story for people not to get discouraged and to deal with adversity as Jim was able to do.
And there's a...
What I love when I give that story in different audiences, the reaction is incredible. The people to talk about their upbringing and how they didn't have the Nike swoosh on their shorts and they didn't have the shiny track shoes. So it's his journey, I think, I don't think I'm convinced it's very inspirational to people.
Well, and I believe the photo is in the book there of him with his mismatched shoes and still out there breaking records. So he performs amazingly at the Olympics, wins gold medals, international hero, ticker tape parade in New York. And then it's not long before it's discovered by happenstance in the book through an interview with a newspaper reporter and a picture on the wall that Jim Thorpe had played him a little bit of professional baseball over the course of a couple of summers, making practically no money, but professional baseball nonetheless. That caused quite the hubbub and the loss of his medals. I guess, we're used to it today with the Olympics, with professional basketball players who make millions and millions of dollars a year competing in the Olympics, but that was sacrosanct back then. And the idea that he had received money for playing sports, even though that was baseball and not track and field, they took his medals away. And it was some of the people that were close to him that even helped sort of enable that. And that's what sort of brings me back to Pop Warner and sort of the new way of viewing his role in that. If either of you can speak a little bit to that.
Yes, that is one of the things that has come out very clearly over the last few years, that the part that they played, there was even, and it's always interesting because in the old Jim Thorpe movie, they've got him speaking before the AAU committee defending himself, and he was never even allowed to defend himself. Warner said, "I don't want a meeting with the whole group." He says, "I just want to meet you, and I want to do it in New York. I don't want to do it up here." So he just went to New York, and the two of them got together and just decided that Jim's medal should be taken away and everything should be sent back to the International Olympic Committee. And that was despite the fact that there was a rule at the time that during the games that said if a competitor's win is in question within 30 days, then there's no way that the medals can be taken away. The decision stands. But despite us knowing that historically, and the people have always been fighting to get his medals returned, did realize that there was supposedly this 30-day rule because it was in the newspapers at the time. So the AAU knew it, and Warner knew it, and Sullivan knew it, that they shouldn't have been taken away.
Well, and they went along with it to protect themselves.
They wanted to protect themselves. Yeah. And when we started dealing with the International Olympic Committee in 1982, we had written letters to President Samaranch of the IOC, and he said, we asked him for a copy of the rules from the 1912 Olympics, and he said, there were no written rules for those Olympics.
Not true.
Not true at all. But that's what we kept on bumping up against. Nobody had a copy of it that we could find. And Sam and the IOC said they didn't have a copy because there were no rules. So I went and started looking through the Library of Congress and found a sports historian there, Dave Kelly, who was just wonderful. So he and I went and looked through, and then it was card catalog. We went and looked through the whole card catalog on anything to do with the Olympics and then narrowed it down to the 1912, and there was nothing that listed the rules for that Olympics. Hmm. And he could see how discouraged I was. So he said, would you like the STAC pass? Where anybody who loves to write, read a STAC pass at the Library of Congress is just wonderful. So I said, of course. So I went and looked through the Olympic materials that they had, and the Library of Congress is a bunch of metal bookcases back to back and goes on for miles. So I went and started looking through everything, was just ready to leave, feeling very discouraged because, again, there was something for every Olympics, but not for that one. So I started walking out, and just something made me turn back. So I just went back and put my hand down. It seems very weird, but I put my hand down between two bookcases that were back to back. And I felt some papers down in there. It was very thin. And I pulled it up, and it was the rules and regulations for that Olympics. And in it was the 30-day rule. So we had them on a legal technicality at that point.
Yes, indeed. So, yeah, basically the rules from those Olympics said if you were going to protest a medal winner, needed to be done within 30 days. And this protest, as it relates to the professionalism of Jim Thorpe, didn't happen until well after that. So
yes,
it was illegitimate to take the medals away on his face. And it took, 70 years. To get that to change, plus, right? Wasn't there something even just within the last couple of years, even beyond the reinstatement, which happened in the early 80s?
We were really discouraged when we realized that the IOC was going to list Jim Thorpe as a co-champion.
Mm-hmm.
So they returned duplicate medals to the family. They fought us on every step of the way. They said they couldn't, they were going to mint some coins for them. And we said, no, we want duplicate medals. And they said, no, we don't have the molds for the medals. And at that time, the Sports Illustrated writer was writing an article about it. And he had one of his colleagues was over there. And he had him look it up. And sure enough, he found the actual molds. For the medals for that year. So they ended up doing duplicate medals, gave them to the kids, and then it came out afterwards that they were only going to list him as a co-champion.
Hmm.
So that's been the cause that we've been dedicated to for the last few years with Right Path Song, which is a Native American-led organization. And the goal was to finally have Jim Thorpe fully reinstated as the champion for those two events. Why don't you tell him about that?
Yes, to have him reinstated as the sole champion. So this incredible group called, as Flo said, called Bright Path Strong. It's a nonprofit, Native-led organization whose mission is, as they say, to create, to share, and to amplify authentic Native American voices and stories, past and present, and to continue Jim Thorpe's legacy of community service. That's a whole other area of his life that's never been reported on after his playing days were over. But they led this incredible fight and had a massive petition drive, and it attracted the attention of Olympic gold medalist Donna DeVerona, who I used to work with at ABC Sports, and I talked to her about him. She said, I'm going to contact you with Anita DeFrance, who was formerly was the IOC executive board member and the U.S. representative. And when we talked to Anita, she wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post that said one of the most egregious miscarriages of justice in sports history and a stunning episode of early 20th century bigotry. So she fought tooth and nail to get the IOC to list him as the sole champion. One thing that you know, this is an incredibly negative quotation that I'm going to share with you, but it was such a driving force for Flo and I to continue this fight, because when we were fighting to get the medals restored and his name restored in the 1980s, we had lunch with Julian Roosevelt, a grandnephew of, here we go, with Teddy Roosevelt. He was the IOC representative to the U.S. and on their executive board, too. And we told him we had 3.5 million signatures on the petition, 2 million of those from the JCs. A gentleman by the name of Ron Busey from the Ohio JC started this petition drive among the JCs that went international. And here's what he said to the report of the Washington Times. He said, in an attempt to convince one of the records to bring up the topic again, that's the reporter asking him, Roosevelt's response was that, quote, the subject is closed. They could get the entire country, the President of the United States, Arafat, and anyone else to sign the petition, and it won't do any good. So that was a done deal until Flo found that document, the rules. And I think in one of the interviews Flo gave, it's interesting that she was able to use the same words that Avery Brundage, who again was good enough to give me an interview time in 1967. It was the shortest one. I say that so that your listeners might not get discouraged when something they request is ignored, but that interview with my tape recorder running lasted about 90 seconds. And I said, why have you not, over the last 40 years, reopened the Jim Thorpe case? And he said to me, son, you don't know your law very well, do you? And I said, what do you mean? And he said, ignorance is no excuse. Mm-hmm. So in 1982, Flo was able to say, ignorance is no excuse, because they ignored that 30-day rule.
To the IOC, right back at you, folks.
Yeah.
Ignorance is no excuse for you either. The fact that you didn't recall
you.
Or couldn't find evidence of this 30-day rule, that's no excuse. Well, I mean, obviously the effort has paid off, has taken a really, really long time. So you're to be commended to that. We only have just about 4 minutes or so left in the show, unfortunately. I could talk to you all for the next 10 hours about this, but I do want to, we always talk about the athletic accomplishments of Jim Thorpe. Can you give me just a sense, his life did not end after his professional athletic career. His life was filled with a lot of heartache. I mean, obviously, you know, his twin brother dying, death was something that he had to deal with on multiple occasions throughout his life, but he also, post his athletic career, if you can ever say there was a post his athletic career, because he was still kicking field goals and things like that in his 50s and 60s. But give me just a little sense of that latter part of his life and his sort of giving back to the community, if you could, very pretty briefly.
Well,
here.
Yeah. Probably one of our favorite things is what he did in Hollywood after. From about 1930 to 1950, when he was a bit player. It wasn't any big roles, and wasn't a terrific actor. When he went to Hollywood in the 30s, it was during the Depression, and he and his friend Cecilia Blanchard created what they called the Indian Center. It was the They needed to create something because the Screen Actors Guild did not allow Native Americans to be members at that time. So if an Indian went in to play a part, well, frequently the Indian parts were played by whites who painted their skin, but an Indian playing an Indian would get half the salary that a white playing an Indian did because they had no union. So he created this Indian Center, and he would bring, they had a place for the people to stay when they first came out. Jim got them jobs because he was the biggest name who knew the most people. And it's just, and he did so much, and he was so generous, probably to a fault at sometimes, but he helped these people so much that eventually they started calling him by the Sac and Fox name Akapamada, which meant caregiver. And so during that whole time, through all those years, he not only supported himself, but he helped other Native Americans to support themselves through the efforts in the film industry. Yes. And that's probably our favorite thing of the things he did. Of course, he went across the country talking about Native American rights and usually doing things for free, not even charging expenses when he talked. But this, after all he went through, here he was for those years trying to help other people survive.
It's just an amazing life, the life of Jim Thorpe. Oh, we could go on and on. That does bring us to the end of the KGOU Readers Club for this week. Robert Wheeler, Dr. Florence Ridlund, thank you very much for joining me today. The book.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Logan.
The book is Jim Thorpe, World's Greatest Athlete. It's not new, but the preface is, and it puts it into modern context. I learned a heck of a lot that I didn't know about Jim Thorpe over the last few days, over the course of my reading of it. Once again, that's the KGOU Readers Club for this month, and I'm managing editor Logan Layden. Join us at the last Monday of next month for our next book. In the meantime, try learning more about Jim Thorpe through Robert Wheeler and Florence Ridlund's book. Thanks for joining me this afternoon.